I began to write, and it really created, I think, it created this person you're looking at as a sort of a bridge. I feel as if I'm a bridge between Spanish and English, between the United States and Chile, between the first and the third worlds, between readers everywhere in that sense. And I think that if I had stayed in Chile, which I really wish I had, I asked the people in Chile, let me stay, let me stay. And they said, ah, you want to write the great novel of the resistance, get out of here. You're so valuable outside. And they were right, you know? So I went out and it changed me too much. It changed me to such a degree, and the country changed so much that I ended up leaving Chile after I went back in 1990, which of course is also in the novel, The Suicide Museum. But
Well,
I repent of having been in exile, but I don't repent of the results that happened to me. I'm so sorry for all those who died in my place.
Ariel Dorfman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Duke University Professor Emeritus, author of The Suicide Museum. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month only, the Governance and Policy Committee will meet on Tuesday, September 12th at 6 p.m. instead of the third Tuesday. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Drinking for Puddles every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland teachers could go on strike as soon as the end of October.
A judge in Washington blocks a ballot measure asking voters to dissolve the county library for now.
And experts offer tips to avoid bank and credit union scams.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 11th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Andrew Black. Portland public school teachers could go on strike as soon as the last week of October. Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero emailed parents on Friday saying they should prepare for a potential strike. Portland teachers' contract ended in June, and they've been negotiating with the district for the past 6 months. They're bargaining over issues like teacher pay, weekly planning time, student discipline, and capping class sizes. September 15th is the last day of their mediation, when both sides can present their last, best, and final offers. If an agreement can't be reached, it sets in motion the strike, which can happen after 30 days. That could mean school and sports closures. At that point, the district would only offer bare minimum services like meals. Angela Bonilla is the president of the Portland Association of Teachers. She said, quote, "Educators are looking around and saying, why am I staying in the district where I don't even have enough time to do the work I need to do to prepare to teach when other districts are willing to give us more time? Same with compensation," end quote.
A judge in Columbia County, Washington, blocked a measure to dissolve the only county library from going to the November ballot. It's been temporarily blocked by Superior Court Judge Julie Carl, ruling that the proposition is invalid. The temporary restraining order lasts 14 days, so the clock is ticking since the first ballots are supposed to be mailed out on September 23rd. Proposition 2 aims to dissolve the Columbia County Library in Dayton, Washington. Last year, a group asked the library to move or take out books that they said were pornographic or obscene. When they didn't get the response they wanted, they created a ballot measure to dissolve the library entirely. Those pushing the ballot measure say they don't want to ban any books, but to move them to areas that are more appropriate than the young adult section. An attorney for the plaintiffs blocking the ballot measure told OPB that there's no evidence that children have ever checked out the books in question. If the measure does make it to the November ballot, people who live in Dayton, where the library is located, will not get to vote on it. Only those who live in unincorporated Columbia County can vote. That's part of what led the judge to issue the temporary restraining order. It gave too much power to rural voters. She also says there's substantial evidence of fraud in the petition signatures that library opponents collected. The next court hearing is September 20th.
A report from the government transparency group Open Secrets finds local politics have become increasingly nationalized, as social media and polarization boost candidates' profiles and their ability to fundraise. Federal candidates from less populated states like Maine have grown to rely on out-of-state donors who will likely never vote for them. Catherine Carley has the details.
Political candidates running for federal office have grown increasingly reliant on out-of-state donations, according to a new report. Government transparency group Open Secrets finds Senate candidates from less populated states like Maine receive more than half their donations from out-of-state, with only a little more than that for House contenders. Research director Sarah Briner says social media is boosting candidates' profiles, allowing them to raise funds from people who will likely never vote for them.
You would just assume that people who are giving to candidates in Maine would be from Maine. That over time has become less and less the case.
Briner says Democrats are more reliant on out-of-state money than Republicans, although the gap has narrowed in recent years. The report finds that ideological donors have increased as a portion of these out-of-state contributors. Briner says political polarization is leading Americans to become more aware of candidates outside their state and how they'd potentially vote on such important matters as climate change or reproductive rights.
You want people representing us as a nation who are in line with your beliefs, whether or not they're representing your interests specifically or your district specifically.
For example, Briner says in the election after Senator Susan Collins of Maine voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, out-of-state donors flooded her opponent's campaign with donations unprecedented in previous Maine elections. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Maine News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
Nike is permanently closing its flagship community factory store on Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The company sold, discounted, and past season items there since 1984. Nike temporarily closed the factory location late last year, citing theft and safety concerns. That temporary closure was later extended from days to months. Earlier this year, Nike officials asked Portland city leaders for increased security in the area as a condition for reopening the store. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said late last week, quote, "I am very disappointed with the closure of the Nike community store on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. My team and city staff have worked tirelessly and in good faith with Nike for almost a year to offer creative solutions to their safety challenges," end quote. Nike did not provide a specific reason for the permanent closure, but said it is considering future locations in the area. A spokesperson said, quote, "True to our roots, we will seek the input of local community organizations and leaders to determine the best new location. As we plan ahead, we're keeping the best interests of our employees at heart, providing them options to continue or be part of the Nike family," end quote.
Scammers pretending to be from credit unions have become a problem in Oregon and Washington. Eric Tegadoff spoke with Matthew Wilson from Oregon Community Credit Union to learn more about the impact of these texts and what people can do about them.
Oregon and Washington credit unions are working together to tackle text message scammers. Credit unions in the region have seen a sharp increase in complaints about fraudulent texts pretending to be from the financial institutions. At the peak of the scam, one credit union fielded between 200 and 400 calls per day reporting it. Matthew Wilson with the Springfield-based Oregon Community Credit Union says members and non-members alike reported the scam texts.
What that does is it winds up flooding our call centers, so that it makes it more difficult to help our members with their daily transactional activity.
Losses from internet scams have been on the rise over the past 5 years. In 2022, there were more than 800,000 complaints and a total loss of more than $10 billion, according to the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center. Wilson says people should delete these messages and double-check if they think they're actually legitimate.
Don't interact with that text message. Go ahead, pick up your phone, call your credit union. If you have their internet banking services online or the mobile app, log in to those known sites.
Wilson says there are regulatory protections for people who are scammed, and while falling victim can feel embarrassing and violating, he encourages people to report the incident.
Don't just sit back, change your password, and think that that's going to be enough. We want to help you. We want to gather up as much information as we can. So let us help you. Pick up the phone, call us, and work with us on it.
This is Eric Tegadoff for Oregon News Service.
While we're talking scams, millions of Americans find themselves financially underwater as monthly payments and interest charges stack up, and many are using debt consolidation and credit repair companies for help. According to a new Better Business Bureau report, some are having bad experiences with bogus organizations. Nadia Romlagan has more in Ohio.
Ohioans seeking help from companies that promise to reduce or eliminate debt or fix their credit scores are getting duped and often are left financially worse off, according to a new report. Better Business Bureau of Central Ohio President Judy Dollison says the rise in student loan, medical, and credit card debt has increased demand for these types of services. The problem, she says, is that not all companies are legitimate.
BBB has had more than 12,000 complaints and negative reviews combined about credit and debit assistance companies, so that just shows you that this is a problem.
The Better Business Bureau advises using a credit report service such as annualcreditreport.com and calling the debt holders yourself to attempt to negotiate a lower payment or interest rate. Dollison says sketchy debt relief, debt consolidation, and credit repair companies offer quick and extensive financial fixes and use high-pressure tactics to get consumers to quickly pay upfront fees.
But what we find is if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. Credit and debit repair actually take months, if not years, to solve.
If a legitimate company has bad business practices, Dollison adds, people can file a complaint or do a customer review. But if they believe the organization is a scam, she says they should use the Better Business Bureau's Scam Tracker site to report it.
Where you can not only report when you've been approached by a scammer, but you can also look up the situation that you're in to see if others have reported that as a scam.
She adds, if you're seeking out a company's services, don't be rushed and avoid giving away any personal banking information until you have evidence it is operating legitimately. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gund Foundation. This is Nadia Romlagan for Ohio News Connection.
As a government shutdown looms, hardline Republicans remain firm on their demands. In spite of trouble in Georgia, Senator Lindsey Graham still supports Donald Trump. And a Boston University social scientist says media consumers need to be on a constant state of vigilance. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Here in the Senate, we have proven there is exactly zero reason for chaos or for shutdown.
With just a dozen days before a government shutdown, Democratic Washington Senator Patty Murray says House Republicans should stick to the funding level Speaker Kevin McCarthy agreed to during the last budget crisis. McCarthy struck a deal with the White House this spring over raising the debt ceiling, but the Speaker now faces pressure from hardline Republicans who say they won't fund the government without steps toward impeaching President Joe Biden. Republican Representative Ken Buck of Colorado says they should focus on border security, crime, and inflation, not impeachment.
Time for impeachment is the time when there's evidence linking President Biden, if there's evidence linking President Biden to a high crime or misdemeanor. That doesn't exist right now.
Buck is a member of the Conservative Freedom Caucus. House Majority Forward, a progressive nonprofit, has announced an initial $20 million investment in voter registration and grassroots mobilization. The program will be focused on signing up youth and people of color spanning from Alaska to Pennsylvania. A special grand jury in Fulton County recommended Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham face criminal charges over 2020 election interference. Graham joined former President Donald Trump's effort to pressure Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger into illegally overturning the state's presidential results. Graham was not charged, Trump was, but the senator says he still supports him.
I am proudly supporting him. He can be a handful at times, but I thought he was a good president. And I'm not going to be deterred campaigning for him and working with him.
83-year-old former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she will be seeking re-election in 2024 to address the challenges facing San Francisco and continued threats to democracy.
Our democracy is at risk when we talk nationally. And globally, people are concerned about what it means if our democracy is at risk.
Boston University social scientist Joan Donovan says social media algorithms are fueling conspiracy theories. Donovan told the conference Friday that a big part of the problem comes when disinformation starts in a social media silo, but eventually gets amplified via mainstream outlets.
A lot of researchers in our field will try to split this and say, oh, it's a cable news problem, or, oh, it's only an internet problem. It's a media ecosystem problem.
Donovan says media consumers need to be in a constant state of vigilance, and the internet needs to better reflect the broad public interest. Finally, today marks the 22nd anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The New York City Fire Department recently added 43 new names to the World Trade Center Memorial Wall, responders who died of illnesses related to rescue and recovery efforts. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News In-Depth. We will be speaking with the Lincoln County residents resisting aerial pesticide spraying over their water supply. Then a conversation with KABU's own Barbara Bernstein about her documentary Once a Braided River, showing at the St. John Cinema tomorrow, September 12th. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Your weather forecast, mostly cloudy tonight with a low of 58. Tomorrow, more clouds and a high of 76. Today in history, in 1970, American actress Taraji P. Henson was born. She's known for her film and television roles that include Empire and Hidden Figures. The quote of the day is from Henson, who said, "Humans have a light side and a dark side, and it's up to us to choose which way we're going to live our lives. Even if you start out on the dark side, it doesn't mean you have to continue your journey that way. You always have time to turn it around."
The vice president of the Oglala Lakota Nation reacts to Trump and other Republicans rallying in Rapid City, South Dakota. Her tribe was not invited to the event. With that story and more, it's Jill Freites with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freites from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. The vice president of the Oglala Lakota Nation reacted to former President Donald Trump's visit to Rapid City, South Dakota on Friday by saying her tribe was not invited to a rally by the Republican Party featuring Trump and reflected on his time as president of the United States as difficult for Indian country. Vice President of the Oglala Sioux Tribe, Dr. Alicia Musso, told National Native News in Rapid City during an interview hours before the rally that she was not in tribal leadership during the Trump administration, but says it was hard working with the administration in her capacity, addressing youth issues with federal funding through the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention.
My previous work with the under an OJJDP grant, providing training and technical assistance for tribal communities was very difficult. We couldn't say certain words, including the word trauma. I was working for the National Native Children's Trauma Center at the time, so it was kind of hard not to say the word trauma, but we were censored. And it's hard to do work when you're censored, do good work in our communities when you're censored from saying certain things. So it was a little difficult, a little concerning. That was the experience that I had when that administration was in.
Dr. Musso says she's not surprised South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem welcomed Trump to the state. The Oglala Sioux tribe has had a rocky relationship with Noem, even telling the governor to keep off the Pine Ridge Reservation.
The Oglala Sioux tribe still has a banishment on Kristi Noem that was from COVID when we had our borders up. And one of our banishments was taken back, but then another banishment was put on. It's been very difficult of the state of South Dakota understanding tribes and our sovereignty and us as a nation. And the things that we have to deal with, and also our status as a political entity. And so it's been kind of difficult considering ICWA and those types of issues that we face every day. It'd be very nice if the state of South Dakota understood those a little bit better.
Trump's visit was part of fundraising for the state GOP, but many speculate it was also to boost his campaign for president. There was also talk in statewide and national media that Noem could likely play a part in his campaign, or if he takes another term in office. Dr. Musso says if that's the case, she hopes Noem would understand tribes, especially coming from a state with 9 tribal nations. The University of Alaska Board of Regents has unanimously approved a $53 million fundraising campaign for an Indigenous Study Center at its Fairbanks campus. The Alaska Beacon reports that Troth Yeddah would be the first university space in the nation designed with Indigenous education models in mind. Troth Yeddah in the Athabascan language means wild potatoes on a hill. Troth is also a word used for wild carrots. The root vegetables are a staple for interior Alaska natives. Charlene Stern, the university's vice chancellor for rural, community, and native education, believes the new center could be a game changer for Alaska. She says it will help address both present-day and historical inequities for Alaska's indigenous students. Currently, Alaska Native Studies courses are scattered across different campus buildings, but the center would bring them together under one roof. It will also be a home to the university's Native Language Program, which has grown from 3 to 12 instructors. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is the only university in the world to offer bachelor's degrees in Yupik and Inupiaq. As of July, the university has raised $5.5 million for Troth Yeddah. I'm Jill Freitas.
In Southern California, the city councils of San Bernardino and Riverside have just voted to dump their crime-free multi-housing programs over legal concerns and issues of fairness and equity. Suzanne Potter explains.
In the past week, two California cities, Riverside and San Bernardino, have repealed most of their crime-free multi-housing programs, which were designed to improve tenants' safety, but have been criticized for destabilizing families, especially in low-income communities of color. The program helps landlords choose better landscaping and lighting and promotes neighborhood watch groups. City of San Bernardino spokesperson Jeff Krause says it also established rules against criminal activity.
Tenants were required to sign an addendum to the lease that if there was illegal activity by the tenant or the guest, the tenants could be evicted. And that component is where some of the controversy lies.
There have been cases in other cities where people were evicted even when the alleged crime took place elsewhere or where there was no arrest or conviction. Families have been uprooted when one member ran afoul of the law, and domestic violence survivors have been evicted after calling police. San Bernardino will still help apartment complexes harden their property against crime, but agreed to scrap large parts of the crime-free multi-housing program as part of a settlement in a case over delays in the city's adoption of a state-mandated housing element. Attorney Anthony Kim is with Inland County's Legal Services, which brought the suit. He notes the program required landlords to do a universal background check on all tenants.
It's already pretty difficult for individuals to reintegrate themselves into society after getting out of jail, and everyone deserves housing, and having a record should not be any sort of precluding elements to that.
A number of people testified against the program at the Riverside City Council meeting, including Desiree Sanchez, who works with the ACLU of Southern California and the Inland Region Housing Justice Coalition.
The removal of the program will ensure the city does not increase homelessness by putting an end to illegal evictions and strengthening the public safety and economy of the city of Riverside.
The city of Hesperia recently withdrew its program after a federal lawsuit said it discriminated against Black and Latino renters. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter, publicnewsservice.org.
As a strike at the Thumbert plant in Newton, Iowa, enters its sixth week, union leaders say the two sides are making some progress on a new wage structure, but remain far apart on the issues of insurance and better work-life balance. Newton is no stranger to labor and management struggles. The Maytag Corporation, the town's largest employer until 2006, went through repeated labor negotiations with workers for the better part of a century. Mark Moran reports.
A strike at the Thumbert manufacturing facility in Newton is entering its sixth week. Workers and company management are trying to come to terms on a labor contract that takes more of the employees' needs into account. Some 84 workers represented by the United Automobile, Aerospace, and Agricultural Implement Workers of America United, better known as the UAW, are on strike at Thumbert, a large manufacturer of electric forklift tires. They've been off the job since August 1st. UAW Local 997 President Steve Wirtz says his team is striking over the same issues that typically prompt a rift between employees and management.
The issues we're facing right now are wages, changes to our health care costs, insurance. We are also dealing with vacation, trying to get people out of there for work-life balance. Those are the main sticking points.
Wirtz says the average worker earns about $23.50 an hour at the Thumbert plant. He says the two sides are within a few percentage points on the pay scale. Wirtz added, workers are asking for a significant increase to catch up with inflation and to be compensated for the extra hours they've absorbed since fire closed a second company factory nearby. Thumbert officials did not respond to a request for comment. Newton has a long history of labor issues. The Maytag Corporation was the town's largest employer until 2006, when, after almost a century, Whirlpool bought Maytag and closed the Newton plant. Wirtz says locals remember that history, which is translated into support for the striking Thumbert workers now.
Retirees, former factory workers have all come out and support us. Businesses in this town are on our side. Meals, water, donations, just anything to help us out. And support of other unions have been phenomenal. Everybody has our back.
While some production methods have improved, Wirtz says factory work remains hot, dirty, and tiring, often requiring assembly line workers to work with equipment that reaches 260 degrees. Despite the labor stoppage, Thumbert currently has several open jobs posted on its website. This is Mark Moran for Iowa News Service.
Climate change is causing water levels in the U.S. to fluctuate dramatically, and that's very true in the Great Lakes region of the country. Worsening storms could make flooding a bigger threat to shoreline property. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Water levels in the Great Lakes can vary dramatically. Some years they're low, others they're high. And over decades, they can fluctuate by up to 6 feet.
The lakes go down just long enough for people to forget that they're going to come back up.
Richard Norton is an urban planner at the University of Michigan. He's part of the Resilient Great Lakes Coast Program, which is helping coastal communities in Michigan plan for shifting lake levels. He says when water levels in the Great Lakes are low for a long time, people might build too close to the shore. Then, when water levels rise again, their property could face flooding and erosion. And as climate change brings more intense storms, with heavy rain and strong waves, the problem could get worse. Many landowners along the lakeshore have built seawalls to help protect their properties. But Norton says that these seawalls only buy limited time.
The day someone puts in a seawall is the day the lake starts to try and take it back out.
He says that in some locations, the best way to prevent property damage may be to limit building too close to the shore. So Norton helps communities along Lake Michigan understand the risks and plan how to best manage their changing shorelines. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 11th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer-engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Jill Freitas, Alex Gonzalez, Mark Moran, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Leitzowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ender Black.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, great folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be talking to folks at the coast about their protest against pesticides in the Seal Rock Water District. Stick around at 5:45 for an interview with KBOO own Barbara Bernstein, the creator of the film Once a Braided River, that will be playing at the St. John's Cinema tomorrow, September 12th. Have a great evening.